Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst. From swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean, these experiences are unparalleled in their historical relevance and grandeur. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to preserve the past to inspire future generations of dreamers. This is accomplished through the youth education program focused on deserving junior high students across California. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, one of the most awe-inspiring locations in the world. The legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture, is woven into the foundation at Hearst Castle's mission. Julia Morgan's life can continue to inspire and empower young women and young men all over the world. This is one of the few opportunities to donate to such an important cause that not only changes the lives and perspectives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors. Please go to the website, foundation@hearstcastle.com, to learn more about how you can help us with our important mission.
Indiana Dunes National Park skirts along the southern shore of Lake Michigan and encompasses 15,000 acres of trails, kayak marshes, wetlands, and forest. The park is ranked among the top 5 birding destinations in North America. There are trails leading up to Mount Baldy, a 125-foot-tall living dune shaped by glacial sands. A bonus of a visit to the dunes are the 5 futuristic homes maintained by the National Park Service that were barged across Lake Michigan at the conclusion of the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. Come along and join National Park Ranger Rocky Wilkinson to discover the rest of the story about one of America's most visited national parks. Carl Sandburg once said, "The dunes are to the Midwest what the Grand Canyon is to Arizona and Yosemite is to California. They constitute a signature of time and eternity. The loss would be irrevocable." Next up, we'll meet Julie Zasada, Executive Director with Cedar Lake Historical Association, that maintains the classic Old Lassen's Resort that's been repurposed as a museum and special event venue. Zasada is joined by Ted Rita, General Manager of the LaPorte, Indiana-based Heston Steam Museum, operators of a classic, circa 1915 steam-powered boat that takes visitors for time travel cruises on Cedar Lake. Michigan City's circa 1858 Old Lighthouse Museum features 8 rooms chock full of historic displays featuring the pioneer days of sailing ships on the Great Lakes and local history. Join the conversation with the volunteer staff at the Lighthouse Museum, Jan and Rod Heppner, Greg Coulter, Kirk Rogers, and Bill Hellyer. Afterwards, we'll step down to the adjacent docks for a visit with Victor Thierry, the skipper of Harbor Country Adventures, MV Amita 2, that takes visitors out on Lake Michigan for park ranger-led tours and sunset sails, with majestic vistas of Chicago's skyline just 40 miles across the lake. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join us.
My name is Rafi Wilkinson. I'm a National Park Ranger here at Indiana Dunes National Park, which is located on the southern tip of Lake Michigan, about an hour to the east of Chicago.
We were just on the top of... Right,
right, Mount Baldy. It's kind of our namesake dune, which is near Michigan City. It's 125 feet or so of just sand, more sand than most people have ever seen.
And what a killer day. There was Chicago's skyline clear as a bell.
Yeah, the lake is very dynamic, and you know, some days it's of course shrouded in fog or clouds, but today we got very lucky. It was really low humidity and we could see Chicago 40 miles to the southwest, and we actually were able to see up the Michigan coastline probably 40 or 50 miles well into the state of Michigan.
Clear as a bell. Loved it.
Yeah, it was.
Talk to us about the history of the national park site and what you're most proud of, what makes it distinctive and unique.
This park was founded in 1966, but actually, you know, there's been a 100-year struggle at what to do with this part of the world, this shoreline. And so actually we have a state park that was originally going to be a national park, nearly 100 years old. World War I and other things got in the way. But then after World War II, again, there was, what are we going to do with this land? And there was a big compromise where we have a steel mill, but we also now have what was originally a national lakeshore that would become renamed in 2019 to become a national park. It's a really special place. It's an urban park, but still has really amazing natural features. And, you know, probably what we're most known for is that we're the fifth most biodiverse of all the national parks. We're more biodiverse than, say, the Everglades or places in Hawaii, with nearly 2,000 species of life jammed into this little 15,000-acre sliver.
That's really cool. And avian, your bird flyway here, that's really incredible.
Yeah, and it's definitely known for that. We sit within the Mississippi and Lake Michigan flyway system. Basically, these birds, as they're flying north and south for migration, they look for large land features. And obviously, Lake Michigan is a perfect navigational guidance. And when they either are coming north and they get to the southern tip, they stop and rest. Or as they're coming south, once again, and they get to the southern tip, they'll stop. And so, yeah, we're in the top five of national parks as far as birding. And we have a wonderful festival every spring in May where we'll see over 200 species of birds in 4 days. And it's a really special place for birding.
And again, it's one of the youngest national parks.
You know, we were a national lakeshore for over 50 years. And in 2019, there was a bill in Congress that authorized our name change. It is an aspect of the National Park Service overall where the name recognition of being a national park brings a lot more visitors. You know, internally, there's 423 national park units, and really, they're all deserved, I feel, of the name National Park. You know, and I really feel the public should go to all 423, not just the 63.
Right.
But so what we see is, you know, Cuyahoga was renamed, White Sands was renamed, the Arch in St. Louis was renamed, we've been renamed.
It is really interesting how default a National Historic Site or a monument, it doesn't have that panache.
Not to the public.
I think
there's 28 different names of those 423, which the commonality is, of course, the Arrowhead, our patch. And internally, again, we're all the same. We all roll up to the same region. Nationally, there's no differences. We don't get paid more. The park does not get more money if it's a national park. But you're right.
It's perception, isn't
it? Its perception is so much more. We ourselves, you know, we sit right next to interstates, you know, 94, 90, 80. And we get visitor after visitor that said, yeah, we used to drive by you all the time. You know, we were on the East Coast and we'd go make our big summer vacation out west and we'd drive by you. But now that our name changed to National Park, they stop and they love it. You know, they realize it. But yeah, it took the name change to make these people stop.
That's really fascinating. Talk to us about your demographics, where people typically, statistically come from to visit you. It seems to me that Chicago would be a big draw.
Yeah, I did a quick analysis, and there's more than 30 million people that live within a three and a half hour drive of us. So we're actually the closest national park to Detroit, to Chicago, to Milwaukee, to St. Louis has the Arch, but of a more natural place, Indianapolis. So you're right, we can pull a ton of people in locally. Again, because of our location on the interstate system, we do have a very large swath of people driving by that come. Certainly now we're on those that are making the 63 park run where they're trying to visit all 63 of them. So also pull in a lot of diversity just because of our location. So we do, you know, with Chicago in particular, having a melting pot of different ethnicities. If you come to our beaches in the summertime, you will see people from all walks of life here.
Talk to us about a surprising aspect, and that's the architectural history here that dovetails back to the 1930s and a world exhibition.
Yeah, that's so if we rewind the clock to the 1920s, there was an expansion of communities out this way. It was before the national parks, and obviously people wanted to live on the lakefront, and in particular there was a town now called Beverly Shores, and there was an opportunity in the early 30s after the end of the Chicago World's Fair of 1933 where different structures, homes were being sold, and the land developer here, the Bartletts, were in trouble. That was after the Great Depression. They needed people to come hopefully buy land from them. And they brought originally 16 structures over from the World's Fair, and there's six of them left. Five of them are owned by the National Park, and so these five homes sit right on Lake Michigan.
And these were future homes, right?
Yeah, a lot of them were to showcase future technologies. You know, one of them is completely made of metal, the Armco Faro, and was designed to be an affordable sort of prefab house. There was a house made out of a new type of concrete called the Rostone House, and maybe most notably there was a called the House of Tomorrow, which was a floor-to-ceiling windowed house. It had a hangar. They thought that every American was going to have a small airplane at their disposal, and so it really kind of showcased what was going to be the future.
A Jetson home of
the time. A Jetson home really was, yeah.
Talk to us about even environmental diversity throughout the seasons. I mean, very different world here in the middle of the winter.
Yeah, we definitely are a four-season park, and there's a lot of parks that kind of shutter in the winter, but we do not. You know, we're definitely a four-season park. We offer programming throughout that, and we do, as I said, see all four seasons from then in the lake. You know, like last February, the lake froze over, you know, where you would see ice to the horizon, and it truly was an Arctic landscape. And today when we were up, we saw people swimming in the lake, you know, below us, and so we do get that. We have a very good fall season with color. We have a great wildflower season in the spring that comes up, and we have these big expansive times of lupins, these great purple flowers that permeate throughout our oak savannas. We definitely have good hot summer weather. We just came off a week of really classic August Midwest heat. Luckily today it broke and we had a really nice low humidity day.
Perfect day.
Yeah.
Talk to us about where people stay in the local communities when they come to visit the park.
Sure, and one of the interesting things, you know, we're a very urban park, there's no doubt about it, and so we do have a ton of nearby communities, so whether or not you want to camp, you know, the state park has a campground, we have a national park campground, there are four or five other campgrounds in the area that obviously host visitors to us. There's B&Bs, and certainly there is a large hotel network between Michigan City and Chesterton and Valparaiso and Portage and Gary, you know, there's places to stay. So people do not have an issue. Like a lot of times if you're going to go to a very remote park out west where lodging could be an issue and you're hours and hours away, there is plenty of lodging, of restaurants, of amenities, you know, right next to the park.
And nearby national parks, what would be the closest?
Well, so we have a great part of the National Park Service called Pullman. That's our closest relative. You know, that's in the southern part of Chicago and really addresses what happened at the Pullman Railroad Company with work riots. And you know, that was an ugly time between unionization and sort of the workforce and corporate. And that really details that. Our closest sister park would be Sleeping Bear. And that's up
in Michigan.
In Michigan. It's up near the, it's on obviously on Lake Michigan, but Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore is a wonderful park and is like us, but obviously different looking, but obviously protects the shoreline of Lake Michigan as well.
But they have a comparable sand dune, right?
They do very much, and it's a different system. They started with a large bluff formation, and the sand has now been blown up over it. So their dunes are actually taller than ours. Mm-hmm. But if you were to cut through theirs, you'd see that there's earth up where ours are 150 feet of pure sand. So it's a different topology. But yeah, there's a great sand dune up there, great camping up there. They also have two islands in Lake Michigan, North and South Manitou Island, which offer a really unique experience to go out and actually camp. And then North Manitou is our closest federal wilderness area where there's truly, you know, you camp anywhere you want, but you have to bring everything over because there's no camp store to help you out. And it's on a ferry, and so you have to be careful of storms where you may get caught an extra day until the storm clears. But, yeah, great place. And obviously you keep going north and Pitchard Rock and Apostle Islands and, you know, the Great Lakes were part of that cluster of parks.
I love it. Well, I could keep you all day, but I've got a ride waiting to take me on. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and thanks for the opportunity, and obviously we hope that your listeners will come out and give Indiana Dunes a try. Really easy to get to, and really a fantastic place.
If somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
So the best way to find information out is certainly we're part of the National Park Service website system, which is nps.gov, or, you know, really the best way is if you Google search Indiana Dunes National Park, you know, that website is going to come up. We certainly are on Facebook, we are on Instagram, and we do our best to remain current with that, or to stop by our visitor center here, which is located, you know, really centrally in the park. And my name is Rafi Wilkinson with Indiana Dunes National Park.
Rafi, thank you so much. What a wonderful day exploring the park.
Thank you so much.
All right, and I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Indiana. We'll see you here.
I'm Julie Zazada. I'm the executive director of the Cedar Lake Historical Association, which operates the museum at Lassen's Resort on the shores of Cedar Lake.
In the heart of Indiana.
Cedar Lake, Indiana, yes.
And I'm Ted Rita. I run the Heston Steam Museum, which is a museum of all kinds of steam artifacts. And our job is to really illustrate and teach our guests what steam power did for the world, how it improved the quality of life globally.
Talk to us for a moment about the steam-powered boat that you have operational that takes people out on rides on the lake. That's really cool.
I partnered with the Heston Steam Museum and Ted's operation in order to recreate what's called the Dewey Line. The Lassen's Resort had a fleet of steamboats that would ferry passengers back and forth from their resort to the Monon Railroad Depot, which sat on the edge of Cedar Lake shoreline. And so when Ted came to visit and saw that piece of history, he got a little bit excited because he knew of a way that we could recreate that experience.
So back in the day, a lot of people arrived by train here, right?
Yes.
So they would go from the depot. How would they get here?
They would travel from the Monon Railroad Depot across the lake in the Dewey Line steamboats.
So this partnership is really cool because for us at the Heston Steam Museum, it takes our mission and then also couples it with the mission of the museum at Lassen's Resort to tell that resort story, but also tells that steam-powered story too. And it's just a whole nother genre that we added to our campus of steam exhibits. We've got a steam sawmill. We've got steam railroad trains that run on our property. We've got electric power plants, agriculture equipment, but this steamboat really is just this whole nother thing that we never thought would happen, and we found a perfect place to do it, telling two stories at one time.
Saw historic photographs in your museum back in the day of the original fleet of steamboats, and it's amazing how close you did this rebuild. Talk to us about making the modern steamboat.
Well, that was a really tricky part, and it's kind of fun for us at the Heston Steam Museum to improve and innovate. But when Julie and I came together to try to do this experience for our guests, we had to get the buy-in of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. They have jurisdiction on Cedar Lake and Indiana's inland lakes. And when they heard we wanted to run a steamboat for passengers or hire, their immediate thing was like, we're not going to do that. But we had some really great field officers that came and did a courtesy inspection. They met our crew. They talked about my steam experience and my volunteer steam experience.
And you've been doing steam work for 30 years, right?
Yes, I've been involved with the museum for more than 30 years and restoring all kinds of artifacts. The field officers began to have some confidence after a courtesy inspection, and we actually had to innovate, and we improved the boat so much that the officers downstate actually began to be malleable, and we satisfied all their concerns, and we're now the only steamboat in Indiana that you can buy a ticket to ride on, and it's quite an experience, I think.
And you recently won a really cool award. Tell us about that.
So we experimented last year in 2021 with a program called Steam Through History, and it was fully grant funded. It was just a way to test this whole idea and see if people were going to really bite on this steamboat ride experience. In 4.5 days, we had over 1,000 passengers ride back and forth from our hotel to the former site of the Monon Depot and back again. So we found out that it was going to be wildly successful, and we were very excited and brought it back this year in 2022. However, what we did was take that Steam Through History project and submit it for an award through the American Association for State and Local History. And we're very excited to learn that our entry was elevated to win the Albert B. Corey Award. They only give one a year for creativity, imagination, and vigor in historic presentation. And they chose to award that to the Dewey Line. So we're very proud of that.
Congratulations. Another question has to do with, you're a tourist destination, a travel destination, but you guys have done phenomenally well engaging and harvesting riders from the local
town, right? Tell us about that. That's really cool.
Yeah, we found that we had the most, almost bang for our buck with the little local newspapers that would run articles about this experience, and all of a sudden the phone would start ringing off the hook, when can I come ride? And I'm like, I'm sorry, you missed it. It was a one-week experience. And so we did do a bonus day last year. We called it our little encore day of presentation, and had about 150 people who were able to come out that day as well and experience the boat. But this year was really the proof of concept to see all these people coming back and visiting. Now we do once a week, we do rides.
And you know, what was really cool for me is to see some of these Cedar Lake citizens. And the Heston Steam Museum, we're in LaPorte County. We're a county away. And we've been welcomed by this community so greatly. You know, when we go out to lunch or whatever, people start to recognize us from the steamboat crew, you know. But what was cool for me is this underserved population that Cedar Lake has. On the lake, there's a lot of private homes. And what we saw was all these neighborhoods, these modern neighborhoods that sprang up outside the range of the lake. You know, they moved to quote unquote Cedar Lake, and then they don't have access to the lake.
There's some people that have never been on the lake.
Yeah, we have a 16-year-old volunteer who lives across the street, and he had never been on the lake before. He turned to me on that steamboat and said, this is the first time I've ever been able to ride. And then I also have a board member who has lived here for over 30 years, and she brought her husband out. He's never been on the lake in 30 years. So that right there is two stories where we're making an impact in people's lives.
And the bonus is your museum, as we just went through. And you're learning how the lake first came to exist.
We tell the story of Cedar Lake from its glacial formation all the way through the height of the resort era.
Talk to us for a moment about the heyday of the resort here. This is really cool.
Yeah, only a little 800-acre lake, but it had over 50 resorts situated on its shores. And some of them were as large as 100-room hotels, and some of them were as tiny as more like 25 rooms. So you had something for every budget and for every lifestyle. Some were lavishly furnished. Others, maybe you were just going tent camping. They didn't even have a hotel. You were just bringing your tent or bringing some sort of motor home or something like that.
Back in the day, it was primarily Chicago market.
Vast majority of the population was coming out of Chicago, especially on the Monon Railroad. They had a terminal end in Chicago, and they would come through Cedar Lake and down into Indianapolis.
Talk to us for a moment about casting the net wider. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from California, mm-hmm. and I never thought I'd be on Cedar Lake, and here I am.
It's been fantastic. So we have started to reach out, especially through the tourism bureaus. We went to a travel and tourism conference this year to start to network with people around the state who are running amusement parks and other living history centers, and talking to them and brainstorm with them about outreach.
Really what we do at the Heston Steam Museum, and what we've encouraged Julie's group to do, is really to rethink what you've been doing and become a history attraction. Not really just a museum. We need to attract people. And so we become this history attraction so that we can really encourage economic development within our communities. That's so important for us as nonprofit 501c3s to give back to our community. And the way we can do it by helping ourselves is to attract people. And so we're in the business of getting people to come to our communities to help the economy.
Place-making destination. So I've been following a lot of what they're doing in the economic development circles. And our pier is a great example of this. There was never a place for anyone to ever go. No pier, public pier, in the town of Cedar Lake until last year when we started this program. And so we needed a pier to load people onto that steamboat. And that was part of that grant process. And we went to the town and we said, look, here's what we want to do. And they're like, we're not so sure about you having a private pier. We're like, we don't want a private pier. We want a public pier. And so that's exactly what we did, was we worked with the town and they augmented our original plans and turned it into a little simple 200-foot long pier into a 250-foot long gorgeous pier with slips for people to come up and bring their boats and get off and come to the museum, but also for us to launch the steamboat. But then it's also open 24/7. Benches at the end of it. You're able to enter out into that space and be out over the water in a way that was never possible before.
I noticed there's a DNR boat out there.
Police, fire, and DNR on one side. side, and then you get the public slips on the other side.
They won out too.
Exactly. It was a wonderful partnership. And then we also added the history panels out there. So now when you're walking along the pier and the museum's not open, you're able to see some of the stories that are told inside the museum, learn some history of Cedar Lake. Hopefully your interest is piqued, and then you're encouraged to come make a visit at the museum as well.
Earlier, you had budgeted $18,000 for the pier. And in the end, you were able to save that money.
We ended up just reinvesting into other aspects of the pier and augmenting what was offered.
As nonprofits, we really don't talk about income. We talk about funding. So we're always looking at funding next year, you know. So that's really important. It's just a little bit different mindset than a for-profit corporation, you know, looking out for profits. What we want to do is we want to fund next year so that we can give great experiences to our guests and also have high morale in our volunteers that give so much to our organizations. I mean, without the volunteers, and Julie included, she's a volunteer, this wouldn't happen. And it gives them actually a quality of life. It gives them something to do. Julie has volunteers that, you know, one of their reasons they get up in the morning is to come to the museum. So it's a great way to engage the community and give community pride, too.
In addition to offering steamboat rides, you do some other cool special events. Like right now, we're in a room that's going to be transformed into a Roaring Twenties bar.
Yes, it is.
With a live foxtrot band next door.
Yeah, 4 short nights. This is going to be a speakeasy. So, yeah, we'll bring in a bar to do a package for us and a caterer. And then, yes, a foxtrot band, as well as a professional dance couple who will give a performance and then engage the crowd and give lessons on how to do the foxtrot. So it's a wonderful party. And everyone dresses up, so that adds even more to that. Our first wedding as well on the museum porch this past weekend, which was really exciting.
So it's a constant dream time to come up with new and different ways to create events and engage the community.
Yeah, we just finished a community art show. We always participate in the events going on at the town, so whether it's their 4th of July Summerfest or their Labor Day party, we try to tie into that and make sure that we have activities going on at the same time, so we're part of that larger community. I mean, this is for community benefit, this entire museum. Why we're here is to give the community a place to go and discover history and make memories and share new experiences.
To learn more about your world,
LassensResort.org, so it's LASSENS Resort.org, and
the Heston Steam Museum is at Heston.org, HESSTON.ORG.
Social media, right? Facebook?
Yes, yes, we're both on social media. So
Facebook,
yes.
People.
Yes. You'll find those connections off of our webpage, yeah. My name is Julie Zazada. I'm the Executive Director of the Cedar Lake Historical Association, which operates the museum at Lassens Resort.
My name is Ted Rita. I run the Heston Steam Museum in LaPorte County, Indiana.
Thank you both. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Indiana. We'll see you here.
This pier would have been Lassen Brothers Pier, and it would have been 100 feet further out into the water on pilings. We would have had a dance floor that we could dance with 1,000 of our closest friends. We would have had a buffet restaurant that was...
We're at the Old Lighthouse Museum in Michigan City, Indiana.
Jan Hepner.
Greg Coulter.
Rod Hepner.
Kirk Rogers.
Bill Hellier.
This is the original lighthouse.
It's the real thing, built in 1858, yes.
No longer an operative lighthouse.
Next year will be our 50th year here as a museum.
Give us an example of some of the most fascinating, cool things that you have here to see.
Well, we have a very famous lighthouse keeper named Harriet Koufax. She was a lighthouse keeper here from 1861 to 1904, 43 years. She ran this place by herself, and she was responsible for several lights, and she did an A1 job for that many years.
She was 80 when she retired?
She was 80 when she retired. And the federal government, when she retired, hired 3 men to take her place.
How about you, a favorite thing to see or do here?
A lot of the early Michigan City history, especially around the turn of the century,
all the businesses were here and the tourism. Sometimes they would have 100,000 people come into Michigan City on the weekends from the tour boats that cruise the Great Lakes.
They would come from Chicago or?
From Milwaukee, up in Michigan.
This is a real popular vacation getaway spot.
It was back before the invention of the automobile. The steamer, like from Chicago, was just 36 miles away across the lake. It was a short, it was not a long trip, and they could get back because it was
quicker back then than today.
And then they built the South Shore one, was that early 1900s. So before there was a road to get here, train, take a steamer, and it was a place to vacation and get away from the city.
Yeah. We had an amusement park, we had band concerts, we had swimming on a beautiful beach, we could climb a huge sand dune called Hoosier Slide, which was right across the harbor here. It was 200 feet tall. There was many things to do on a beautiful summer day.
And there was a manufacturing base here, right?
We had the largest was Haskell Barker Freight Car Company, started in the 1860s and later was sold to Pullman in the 1920s. But around 1900 or so, it was the largest industrial complex in Indiana. It employed between 3,000 and 4,000 men, and they built freight cars. Henry Ford is given the distinction of starting the assembly line, but actually here in Michigan City, they were building freight cars long before Henry Ford, a railroad track that went through the plant that started with just wheels, then they put the floor in, and into the next place where they built the rest of the boxcar, then it went to the paint factory, and when it came out, it was a completed freight car. And they were very effective and very successful. They continued to make freight cars here up until early 1960s, I believe.
How about you? Talk to us about what you're most proud of, what you enjoy here.
I think the thing that I most enjoy about the Old Lighthouse Museum is the lantern room at the top. It's definitely the thing that whenever there's a guest visiting, we make sure that they know to make it all the way up to the top. And then whenever they're on their way out, we double check that, hey, did you go all the way to the top? And yes, yes, yes.
But there's no longer a light up there.
Exactly. So the light was moved from this house out to the lake in 1904. And then when they built the museum in 1963 and opened in 1973, they put a lantern room at the top. And then in 2007, they got grants to make it accessible to the public.
And how about you, a favorite?
The Fresnel lenses. We have order 5 out here by the entrance, which was never on the house. But we have 4 over here in the case, and it has some copper on it, which wasn't original to it. But there were stories of vandalism through the years or people not wanting, there were no street lights yet. So they weren't used to lights shining in their house. And when this light from the lens showed up, they weren't real happy about it. So we don't know which one's true.
So they put the copper on to block the light shining into town.
And another thing is our doorbell is original. So we like, especially with the little kids, you know, say, pull up. And that if you ring the doorbell, that means you're going to come back.
Still ringing.
It's a miracle. It's still here. It was boarded up since 1940 to 65, and nobody stole it. Solid brass.
That's really
cool. I want to mention, too, Kirk and Rod's family have lived here for many, many generations, actually, and they can tell stories. That's kind of the fun of working with folks here. And Jan's family, too, many generations. They have so many stories. And Kirk's family, actually, his great-grandfather was instrumental in the factory over here, the big Haskell and Barker factory. In fact, that fireplace you see there was in his great-grandfather's house.
Oh, wow.
So Kirk has a great connection to the museum, to the city, and all the stories that we have.
It implies that there's still that sense of community and multi-generational community pride.
That's correct, yes.
And tell us your favorite story.
How about your group? Is that your grandfather?
Oh, my great-great-grandfather was like the third doctor in town. He came here in 1853. And his son was in the life-saving service and in the volunteer fire department. And his house was pretty much where the library is now, right across the street.
He built it?
As far as we can tell, yeah.
Did he keep any notes or records or any?
No. Well, you've got copies of his license he had to buy every year. We got copies of that. One large picture of him. Oh, this big.
He didn't think he was important, right?
My cousin took all his instruments and his guns.
Well, Kirk's great-grandfather then And maybe you could tell a little bit about the history of your grandfather, great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather came from New Hampshire, moved out west to Chicago. It sounded like he went to the old west, but he didn't like Chicago. It was too sinful, so he moved to Michigan City and got a job working for Haskell Barker, and he eventually became the secretary treasurer. And he was here till he passed away. And then my grandfather worked for Pullman Standard until the 1940s, and my dad worked in Pullman Standard till the early 1970s. So we have over 100 years of people working for the car factory.
And how about you? What, did you stay here most of your life?
Yeah, I stayed most of my life. Went away to college. A few years I taught up in Michigan, but then I moved back because of aunts and uncles and grandparents and other people that are around. And once we had children, that was more important. Plus, I love the lake, I love the beach. I love, the winters aren't so great, but I just love the area. Yes.
It gets quiet in the wintertime.
Yes.
Very busy in the summer with all the tourists, and then very quiet just for us folks in town here to enjoy.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so my family moved here in the 1830s. We bought land originally from the federal government, and Native people helped us build our homestead. So it's one of our family histories is that we were a little honked off when they were removed and taken out to first Kansas and then Oklahoma, which is just, it's an interesting family memory where like my extremely conservative grandfather is like, we were mad at the federal government for removing Indians. And like, cool. I'm glad that that was the reaction of people at the time. And it's interesting to think of how the memories changed where people are, by the end of the century, were using Indians as mascots, Native people as mascots, and just had forgotten that story.
It's still really an untold story.
For sure, yeah. We were talking to one person today about recreating some of the indigenous presence in the dunes and restoring some walking trails and just keeping that memory alive, keeping that presence alive.
But most people are aware of the Trail of Tears out of eastern Tennessee and North Carolina, but they are not aware that there was a removal from Michigan and Wisconsin and Indiana.
Yeah, so the Potawatomi Trail of Death started around here. An interesting fact about that is that the spot with the historical marker is getting turned into a EMS center. But yeah, so the 1838 Trail of Death started here. It took the Potawatomi out to Kansas and then Oklahoma. One of my other answers for my favorite thing in the museum is Trail Creek. So the reason Michigan City is here and the reason the lighthouse is here is Trail Creek. So I'm not going to try to say the indigenous word for the river, but the French is the Rivière du Chemin, which is the Trail Creek, is still in French. So this is where Native people knew to turn inland to get to forts and trading spots because the Great Kankakee Marsh was still here by that point. So we forget that there was no going south from the tip of this lake.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
So you had to go east to go south. That's what made this corner of the lake important.
So it was a real travel center then.
Yeah. So LaPorte is called LaPorte, LaPorte County, the county we're in, which is the door in Potawatomi. Well, in French, of course, but Potawatomi, it's Squatum. So where my family moved to in the 1830s is interesting because it's right next to where there was a Potawatomi village. And in one of the maps upstairs, it shows them being called Sacthum, which sounds like Squatum, which is French for the door. So it's cool to think that maybe there's a line to throw there for the Potawatomi naming this area after the transportation hub, which of course Indiana is the crossroads of America, so it goes all the way back to that.
That's really cool.
My people, one branch, came over here from Prussia in about the 1880s, and a good number of them worked for Kirk's ancestors at Haskell Barker.
Like to encourage people to visit Northwest Indiana because there's more than corn in Indiana, and you get north of US 20. We have beautiful dunes. We have a national park. It's the second busiest national park in the United States, according to a report that I read. Also, beautiful, again, the lake, many activities, many wineries, breweries, a lot of restaurants.
175 restaurants.
75 restaurants. We have a zoo here in Michigan City. It's a fun place to be. So we encourage people to come and visit the Michigan City area.
To learn more about the Lighthouse Museum, do you have a website?
Talk to Greg about that. He's our office.
So we're getting ready for our 50th year, and there's a lot we're getting done with that. We're redoing our gift shop. We're doing the grounds up a bit, and we're getting that website on its feet. So we've updated the About section as recently as today. And Yeah, you can learn all about us on there, our hours and our admission, and the days we're open because we close for the winter.
And the URL is?
Seahistorical.org.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One thing to add is that, like, for people coming from St. Louis or somewhere, like, they can go 16 hours to get to Florida or 5 hours to get to southern Lake Michigan. So we get a lot of people from that part of the world and just, like, the center of the continent, because it's either spend your entire vacation driving or 5 hours to Indiana.
That's really cool.
My name is Victor Thierry. I'm the owner of Harbor Country Adventures in Michigan City, Indiana, a tour company.
A tour boat?
Tour boat company. In the middle of the lake, and I'm thinking, how the hell did they find anything? Columbus, the explorer, like how?
All the way around the world.
Yeah.
And hit it.
I felt like I had a leg up when I went to get my captain's license. Mm-hmm. I'm ex-military, Army. So I understood, you know, coordinates, latitude, longitude, all that. There were a lot of guys that were struggling in my class. But I'm like, navigating off the stars on the ocean? I couldn't even imagine. Like, how'd you find anything?
I know, and they did. Tell us about what you do and when you do it.
We do narrated sightseeing tours 7 days a week from Memorial Day to Labor Day, twice a day. On the weekends, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, we have a program called Riding with the Ranger, where the National Park Rangers from the Indiana Dunes National Park come out, and they lead the tour. And it's pretty special. They have all these great stories, and they talk about the history of the park and the lakes and the shipwrecks that we have. They have great entertainment for the family. The kids have an opportunity to earn a junior ranger badge. And then when we're not doing that, we do a lot of corporate, private events every night. From 7 to 9, we offer a spectacular sunset cruise, weather permitting. We have live entertainment on our top deck. And
some food?
We do. We have light snacks available for purchase at the bar. And then we set sail between Michigan City, Indiana, and New Buffalo, Michigan.
Here we are today. We're not going out because of the seas and the wind. But we can see beyond the harbor the skyline of Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah, 40 miles, and you can see it crystal clear tonight. Across our lake lies the city of Chicago. Unfortunately for us, we are on the most southern portion of the lake, and when the winds are out of the north, we catch the brunt of that. So on days like today, unfortunately, we're just stuck at the dock.
And your season starts when and ends when?
So we open, we try to be open at the beginning of May every year. Once again, weather permitting. At the very latest, we're open by Memorial Day. We run full-time, 7 days a week operations through Labor Day. Once the kids go back to school, the midweek stuff, we don't do tours for the public, but we do a lot of senior, civic groups, corporate events, things like that during the week. And then Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, we resume our normal touring schedule to the public.
To learn more about your world,
you can visit us online at harborcountryadventures.com. It shows all the tours, the times, all the different things that we as a company offer. And my name, once again, is Victor Thierry, the owner.
Victor, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Indiana. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst. From swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean, these experiences are unparalleled in their historical relevance and grandeur. The foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to preserve the past to inspire future generations of dreamers. This is accomplished through the youth education program focused on deserving junior high students across California. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, one of the most awe-inspiring locations in the world. The legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture, is woven into the foundation at Hearst Castle's mission. Julia Morgan's life can continue to inspire and empower young women and young men all over the world. This is one of the few opportunities to donate to such an important cause that not only changes the lives and perspectives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors. Please go to the website, foundation@hearstcastle.com, to learn more about how you can help us with our important mission.
Why don't you go where Harlem sits for another riff? Spangled gowns upon a bevy of high brown from down the levee, all misfits putting on the riff. Why, that's where each and every Lulu Bell goes every Thursday evening with her swell bow rubbing elbows. Come with me and we'll attend their jubilee and see them spend their last 2 bits putting on the ritz.